Hello and welcome to the Tech and Trees podcast. Last time I talked to Romain Diaz, the founder of Satgana, a venture capital fund that invests in climate-focused companies in Africa. This time I talked to one of the founders who was too good for Romain to pass on and compelled him to invest in his company. My guest is Jesse Forrester, founder and CEO of Mazi Mobility. Jesse is building an electric motorcycle company out of Nairobi in Kenya. But he was in South Africa for a couple of days and we managed to link up in person. He lets me in on how Mazi is his path to immortality, his vision of building the premier company in Africa that moves people, data and things, and why he would rather focus on hiring technicians than engineers in the early stages of building a hardware company in Africa. Jesse is a force of nature, thoughtful and well-spoken. So sit back and learn about Mazi Mobility.
To start off, I would like to ask you a few questions to get to know you better as a person. And the first one is one that I regularly ask, and that is, what's a formative childhood experience of yours?
One of them, the one that comes to mind is when I was really young, I have a deep fear of locusts. It's irrational. But when I was a kid, I think about like 4 or 5, someone put a big desert locust on my ear. And I remember looking and seeing it at the corner of my eye. And when something's that close to your face, it looks massive. And ever since then, I've just had an irrational fear of locusts.
Not that you're directly going for the negative one, fear that we're talking about before. I know. Okay. How would your mom describe you as a person?
I think she'd describe me as a thoughtful individual. I tend to get that quite a lot. Playful and funny, but also serious, and focused and motivated. Yeah. I have an interesting story. When my mom was working quite a lot when I was quite young, one of the things she mentioned was, I said, hey, why don't you take a couch to your office and sleep in the office so that you're there before your boss and he can give you a promotion so you don't have to work that much. So I think she'll say something to that regard. And it's quite interesting because it's Mother's Day on Sunday. So I'll ask her again and I'll let you know in Nairobi what she says.
That's a good question. What do you appreciate about your mom? Thinking of Mother's Day.
Indeed. Lots of things. I mean, she gave me life. So it's like always going to be massive. But I just think the way she, you know, kind of like when you think about like an African mother or African parents, it's just a lot of like a separation between how you should interact with them. And me and my mom are quite friends. And I think her approach was more of like, we're kind of peers going through life as opposed to I'm your mother, which I think was quite unique for people of her age group and how they grew up. You know, we had lots of conversations and gave me and my sister a lot of autonomy to think about choices and make decisions at a very young age. So I think that's one of the things I really like about our dynamic and I appreciate about her.
Okay. You're an entrepreneur in Africa, so I'd also like to get your opinion on what is the thought that people need to really leave behind when it comes to Africa?
That is one single market. I think you hear people say, oh, yeah, you could do this there, you could do this there. It's 54 different markets. Yeah, there's some things that are analogous, some things that are quite similar, but it's just a little bit different in every single place that you go. An entrepreneur from Nigeria is not going to face challenges in a very similar way to an entrepreneur in Kenya. It's not going to face the same entrepreneur here in South Africa. And even if you look at the industry that I'm in, which is e-mobility, you just really see even the organization of how the customers who are motorcycle riders or commercial motorcycle riders is quite different, right? So East Africa, there are millions of motorcycles. South Africa, less so. There's more of a fleet focus here. In Kenya, there's more of an individual ownership focus. So I'll just say, you know, when you're thinking about the continent, you have to do a lot of almost like customer discovery, market discovery, to really understand where you want to play and why one market is better for a specific thing than another. So that nuance, I think, makes it quite interesting. It makes it a new frontier.
Yeah. So you're saying, okay, locally specific knowledge is important. So I'd like to know, what is something about Kenya that only, because as you are from Korea, that only somebody from Kenya would know?
That's a great question. Is that in terms of entrepreneurship or just in
anything that comes to mind?
Yeah, I think one would be just where to get good street food. Because sometimes you get eat street food and it like really messes you up. But I think, you know, if you're talking about specific street food and where to get really good street food, I think a Kenyan would know it's like where to. It might be their own what we call a local, where they go, they have something nice to eat, and they're going to show you a little bit of an interesting time. And I think places in Nairobi that are specific to what you call like just like Kenyan space, Kenyan club. I think more of that entertainment kind of scene. If you're with a Kenyan, they're going to show you a lot of a different place. Because when everybody's traveling to Kenya, the first club they hear is one called The Alchemist. And everybody knows about The Alchemist, but there's so many other interesting clubs. But those are just hidden gems where you only find Kenyans or you find locals. And I think it's just a missed opportunity. Nothing wrong with The Alchemist, but there's just so much more.
Selfish question, how do I differentiate the good from the bad street food?
You have to be the Kenyan pasta.
Okay.
I'm not going to give you the sauce.
Fair enough. Need to be friends of Kenyans in that case. Okay, cool. Then I'd say we dive right into what you're doing. And you're the founder and the CEO of Mars Mobility. And I'd like you to explain to me, as I was a child, what is it that you do?
Cool. So Mars Mobility, if you think about it, we've got two things. We've got a motorcycle and we've got a way to charge that motorcycle. So what Mazi does is we import electric motorcycles, the parts, and we assemble them and put them together in Nairobi. Then once they're put together, we also have to figure out that infrastructure piece, which is the charging side. Now, if you're from another part of the world, you're more familiar with charging stations like a Tesla. But what you see with, again, nuance of a local market or developing world is that commercial motorcycle riders are on the road 12 hours a day, 6 days a week, sometimes 7 days a week, and they need to always be on the go. And one of the pitches of electric vehicles with fast charging, which is not good for your battery, fast charging or rapid charge is where you completely charge your battery in 30 minutes. Is that motorcycle riders always need to be on the go. And so instead of charging the motorcycle, what we offer is a battery swap. So a motorcycle rider comes to one of our stations, that's what we call them. We call them MASES, Mazi Swapping Station, very creative name. And they deposit the discharged battery or the empty battery and switch that out for a fully charged one. And they're on the road again in under 2 minutes. And so this is a model we're taking to proliferates electric motorcycles in East Africa.
Can I imagine that swapping station to look a bit like a Formula One boxing stop, or what does it look like?
Great, not quite a Formula One boxing stop. That'd be quite cool. Because ours are unmanned. It's about 1 meter wide. Sorry, it's about 1 meter long, 0.5 meters wide, and 1.5 meters high. And it's a 12 cabinet swapping station. So if you think about it more like a cubby hole or cubby locker, with each of those 12 compartments. So the motorcycle rider brings out the battery, keys in some information. One of the cabinets opens. He slots in the battery, connects the charger, closes the door. And only then do we give them a pricing based on how much they've used. So we don't bill on one flat fee, we bill based on usage. Once that's done, we're then able to, once they've paid actually, we trigger M-Pesa payment. M-Pesa is mobile money transaction. And then once the mobile transaction is paid, another slot opens with a fully charged battery. Motorcycle rider picks the battery, closes the door, puts it back in his motorcycle and is on the way. And so this process takes under 2 minutes.
So you have the two components to your business. Then you have the electric motorcycles and the charging stations.
Exactly.
Okay. And do you then have a network of these charging stations distributed across Nairobi? Like, yes. how do you choose where to put these? Like, regarding the I guess you're using some traffic data, whatsoever.
Right. That's a great question. I think one of the things we looked at it from the beginning was looking at that traffic data, but you just realized that electric motorcycles are a little bit different from even petrol ones. Just because the utilization patterns are going to be different because it's a different product. With petrol, you've got petrol stations everywhere, so the motorcycle riders are less careful about where they go. With an electric bike, you have to be a bit more careful because if you run out of charge halfway across the city and there's nothing there to help you, then you're in trouble. So what we've done is we've looked at high demand areas, targeting food delivery as an initial beachhead market. Set them up at these delivery pickup points or high demand areas as an initial starting to gather some data. And once we've done this, and once we now have done this, we're then deploying more swapping stations across the city. We've also got what's called a battery fleet management system. We call that BFMS at Mazi. And this gives us specific distance data, battery data, and a bunch of other data points that then allows us to be smarter about the next place we put swapping stations. So we're refining the data models that we're collecting. And you can imagine if you're going to go to a new city or to a new country, setting that up becomes even easier and more methodological than just kind of saying, this is a high demand area. It makes sense to put it there. Again, have a bit of local knowledge. I know where exactly it's high demand for delivery, and this is quite interesting when you think about mobility or any form of transport. It's quite localized, and it's the same if I was to go to, you know, Cairo. I wouldn't really know exactly the places that I have to work with an Egyptian. So I think that's one of the things that makes it quite interesting when deploying mobility solutions. So thinking about what is scale going to look like for a company that originates in Kenya and wants to spread its wings across, you know, multiple countries.
Yeah. Before we get into more of the business building, I'd actually like to know you, why does it matter to society, to Kenya, to people?
If we look at the average Kenyan household, they mostly own a motorcycle. There are about 5 million motorcycles in East Africa, 1.8 million in Kenya, and they indirectly and directly support about 5 to 6 million people, which is about 10 to 11% of the country, right? And so it's quite pivotal and crucial when these people are able to earn 150% increase on their net take home every single day. Immediately, they get an electric motorcycle. You just put so much money in people's pockets that goes into things like healthcare for their kids, that goes into even in entertainment for themselves, goes into groceries, etc. Whatever they want to use the money for, you're enabling them to earn more. And then when you think about it, if you contrast a petrol bike and an electric bike, a petrol bike has a lot of vibrations. It also has a lot of spares and moving parts. And an electric bike doesn't. And so your maintenance cost drops significantly as well. We say that number is 52%. So you're not only earning more, you're spending less on maintaining your vehicle that you use 80, 90% of the time. Unlike, you know, maybe you, Pascal, or I, who may have a car that it's packed most of the day and you're only using it 5% of its life. But the big also aspect is the climate one. We know that electric motorcycle mitigates about 3 to 4 tons of CO2 emissions every year. And this is massive. So you can imagine if you scale that to 5 million motorcycles that are producing this amount of pollution every year, you know, around almost a gigaton range of pollution production. And we know that in developing markets, 1 million people die every single year due to air pollution-related diseases. And it's not just CO2, it's also effluent. Sometimes you get this really dirty two-stroke petrol engines that are, you know, more pollutive. Actually, is an interesting stat. It's 10 times more pollutive per mile than an SUV. And again, I keep coming back to this number of 5 million commercial motorcycles. So it's a big, big problem. And us introducing these vehicles mitigates all these challenges. And it's one of those things that you find quite interesting because it is a triple bottom line effect. It's good for the society, it's great for the environment, and it makes money, not just for the company, but also for our customers.
So considering this triple bottom line, how does building Marzi fit with your larger overall life goals?
Again, great question, Pascal. I think when I think about myself, I'm a big believer in, well, I don't think I've ever said this on a podcast or publicly, but I'm a big believer in immortality through actions. I think that a lot of people go by day to day, and some of us, you know, want a legacy to be left. Some people would say, this was Pascal, this is what he did. I think that's a very human thing. But, you know, to be quite honest, there are a lot of really cool people that have existed for thousands of years. We don't know who they are. I think what we can tangibly feel about the human experience is what we did. And so one of the things I think about when I'm considering impact or what to choose to work on is what kind of impact will my actions have on my community, on my society, on the world that have staying power and that are provocative enough to make someone make a change. That ripple effect allows for what I call a sense of immortality. So even if the next 100 years no one remembers Jesse Forrester, if I've done interesting things with electric motorcycles, my impact is still being felt. I am still being felt, even though it's not Jesse as a person. It's more of who I am in my essence. And so when I think about Marzi and companies that I've worked for or work in, that's kind of one of the things I consider. Now, this is not to be misconstrued that I can't work on anything else that may not have as much impact, like AI or things like this. I find those also interesting. But at the end of the day, I think having that outsized effect on society and on people is a great way to leave a legacy. And it takes the ego out of it. It just makes your work speak for you and your work permeate for centuries.
Why is entrepreneurship for you as a person suitable as a tool to achieve this immortality through actions?
I think entrepreneurship is quite interesting because when you think about the current world system, you know, we all say we're in a capitalist society. And one of the things that you see, especially with Africa, there's a really interesting book about aid and Africa not needing aid. Is when people think about development, I think one thing that's tricky is, you know, you need to make sure that it has staying power and that it makes sense. And so when you introduce a solution, if the customer is not able to make money, save money, or lessen their pain in some way, shape, or form, then on the continent, you're already losing out, right? Because, you know, again, it's like that Maslow's hierarchy of needs. A lot of people are not at the self-actualized phase. And so to really ensure that some people really feel the effects of something, you need to build a company or something that can improve their economic condition. And so when I think about that, and I think about the ways to achieve that, entrepreneurship seems to stand out as the best current option to do this. So you could think about, you know, maybe working in government, that's an interesting way, policy and all of these things make sense. But if I look at also how I am wired as a person and what I want to do, then I think entrepreneurship just takes the cake.
Yeah. Then let's talk about what you're building. You're building Marzi. Can you, because I myself am trying to figure out a bit or demystify this step from zero to one, right? Like how to, well, create something from nothing. Can you describe for me the moment when you decided to start Marzi and then the steps that you took from there to whatever represents the first form of Marzi for you? What was it like, this journey from zero to one? Could you go into that for me?
Yeah. So it was back in 2018 when I thought about the company. I was living in Joburg, and I went to a very entrepreneurship-focused school. And when I came back to Kenya, I was focused on doing something interesting, something that would impact something in Kenya or people in Kenya. And I just did a little bit of exploration, thinking about places that I could have a formal solution or some form of idea. And I, you know, one of the things that I've found to be quite interesting is if you're thinking about doing something, go back to some of the interests you had as a child, because I've had a lot of interests across my life. And when I went back to that, I always was interested in factories, machinery. And so that became the area of focus. But then it had to be impact-based. So I started creating these kind of mental rings around what I would not do and what I would do. And at the same time, I was doing a research paper on intercontinental transportation in Africa. And you just realize that Africa needed to spend, I think it was $90 billion over the next 10 years at the time, to bridge the infrastructure gap, which was an insane amount of money, almost $1 trillion.
Infrastructure just in terms of transport, so roadways and...
roadways, waterways, railways. You know, people tend to forget that Africa is quite young in self-governance and compare ourselves to Europe or compare ourselves to the US. They have had 200 years to figure things out. And for those 100 years, there's quite a lot of wars, same as in Europe, right? And so that's something that people don't really understand. When you look at the continent, it seems very barbaric. But if you compare it with all world history of different countries and different regions, it's quite the same. But anyway, so when I looked at that, I thought, oof, this is a very big macro problem, and it seems impossible to solve. But then I thought there might be some micro challenges as well that could angle towards this particular area. And so thinking about that research, thinking about that study, and going out and talking to people, I ended up spending time just in the Nairobi CBD, walking around. And as I was pondering what I was going to do, a matatu, which is a 14-seater van, crossed my path, lots of smoke in my face. And I got really upset. I said, oh man, this is so annoying. Why do we still have this? Why do these guys still drive like this? You know, just like typical if that happens to you. And it kind of just hit me. Why am I complaining about this? Maybe I should think about doing something about it. And so I spent the better part of my holiday in Nairobi town, Nairobi city, with mass mobility operators, hearing their stories. And it really alarmed me how much they spent on petrol. And when you look at the inefficiencies of an internal combustion engine, that is a 40% efficiency versus a 95% efficiency of an electric vehicle.
As like efficiency of energy conversion.
Energy conversion. Yeah, from petrol then to propulsion and from electricity to propulsion. It's mind-blowing. And that's where arbitrage makes a big difference for EVs when it comes to cost comparisons. That's why that's why 150% that take-home comes in, because you're 50% cheaper than petrol. And if you look at the costs of energy versus the cost of petrol, then per kilometer, you're seeing almost 50, 60% difference, right? And so this was quite interesting to me. And I thought, there might be a business case here. And so I couldn't really work on it. I had to go back and finish my studies. And 2019, I came back. I built a wastewater treatment facility here in Joburg. That was quite cool. Also really exposed. Said, I really want to do something in impact. So I was making that school, that campus, for the first time, sustainable. They had nothing that was sustainable or nothing that was sustainability related on the campus. And we took a section of the campus off the grid. And it felt quite cool to do because it was a water treatment, etc. And so when I came back to Kenya off that in 2019, in September, actually in June, I worked for a wastewater treatment company for 4 months. And then I quit and went straight into doing Mazi. At the time, I'd also met a friend of a friend of a friend of a friend. A really interesting
as it goes.
As it goes. a really interesting engineer who became my business partner. And we embarked on this crazy journey where, you know, I was running the business and he provided the initial form of capital, but quite after quite some time. And so it was a lot of time spent really trying to understand what I was going to do, how the business was going to come up, because it was new across the world. There's only one company that was really popular at the time, was GoGrow, that was doing it well, but they had $40 million from HTC to begin their company. I didn't have $40 million, right? And so it was kind of figuring out, how do we get where we need to go? How do we get people to buy into this vision? And at the time, no one believed electric mobility was ever going to be a thing in Africa. And I just thought they were all wrong, because to me, it was just very apparent. If these people are going to spend this much on petrol, then you have a solution and you figure out how to make it cheaper. It's going to make sense. And then finally, the climate aspect of it was too big to ignore. And for customers, they don't really care so much about the climate side. Again, goes to back to your question about like operating in Africa. That's why you need to have that financial component to your solution. Otherwise, it might be really tricky to convince someone to take up what you're offering them. It needs to make money for them. It needs to save them money. It needs to alleviate a pain point. Yeah.
From that realization, finding your business partner, what were the first steps that you took?
Yeah. So I think one of the first things that I did was try and find capital. Went out to market, tried to raise the capital. COVID happened. Now it feels like another lifetime for everybody. No one's wearing masks.
Yeah.
It's insane. Said it's no longer a global emergency. But at that time, it was an incredible challenge. And so during that period in 2020, we had to pause and really think about how we structure the business, because the founder capital was not significant enough to do a 14-seater van, which is what Mars initially was doing. If you look at our first logo, it was actually the logo of a Matatu. And so we then saw this really interesting vehicle segment that was growing really rapidly. That was the motorcycle. And after studying for a while, look at the business case, look at the numbers, we made a pivot and brought in the first 10 Marzi motorcycles by May of 2021. So we spent a year. So COVID to me was in a way a blessing, because we were able to refocus the company's efforts and really think about how we'd make the business scalable. And now, since then, it's just been a lot of hustling for grant money. I mean, I think when you don't have a lot of cash up front, you get really creative about how to fund your idea, especially if you're committed. So we've got a lot of grant funding, got some non-dilutive capital. And where we sit, you know, we're comparable, second largest by bike number on the road in Kenya, with just like a fraction of the capital everybody else has raised. That's quite cool, because we've been really aggressive in terms of figuring out ways to prove the concept and prove the business, not really taking equity until now, you know, where we're going to be raising equity really soon. But yeah, it's quite an interesting, I think, method to think about how to almost bootstrap your business.
Yeah. From other previous conversations, I've gathered so much that you're thinking big. Mm. So could you give me a snapshot of where Marzi is now, in terms of size, bikes on the road, as you just mentioned, and where you want to take it, and what will be like the key milestones that you're looking to achieve on the way?
Our vision is to be Africa's leader in moving people, data, and things, right? So that even abstracts beyond motorcycles. And if you look at the way I've set up together with the different people I'm working with, the business, we're really data-oriented, and everyone says that, but we really look at how we're monitoring almost every single aspect of the value chain and how we can make battery rescues faster, how we can make swapping station deployments quicker and more strategic, how we can ensure that vehicles are just done in a really strong way. And our mission is to power Africans into an electrified future. And so how we're doing that now is by committing to what we say is never miss a swap, right? So right now what we have is unmanned swapping stations, 10 on the way, 55 motorcycles on the road, staff about 10, 15 people. And this is in Nairobi for now. But I see the company within the next 5 years, about 500K motorcycles across 4 or 5 markets. And then being the number one manufacturer of swapping stations in Africa, that's then allowing other people to really replicate our models in places where Mazi can never operate. As I said, if you think about Africa and you think about how massive the continent is and how different the continent is, we want to enable people to do the same thing that we're doing. The idea is to get as many motorcycles out there as possible and to prove that in Kenya and have that distributed in areas where we're not going to be, but also opens up an interesting business line. That's why we are really focused on moving people, data, and things, because that's really the crux of what mobility to me should be. And that's quite interesting. You know, when you think about the definitions of transport and mobility, mobility is a little bit more all-encompassing as a term. So mobility of people, mobility of things, mobility of goods, or transport really says from moving something from point A to point B. Mobility is a little bit more inclusive. And so I think that's where we want to take the company. That's where I want to take the business. It's quite an ambitious, aggressive view. And we know that, you know, things move slower than we expect. My business partner, one of them always says, things are always 3 times as slow and 2 times as expensive. And in my experience, that kind of is a maxim for how I've seen business and things to actually be. Yeah. But yeah, knock on wood, that's where we're going.
Yeah, no, very cool. Do you have like a key KPI that you're looking at for yourself that reflects like the health of your business or like that signalizes to you you're going the right way?
Yeah, so I think it's that metric of never missing a swap, because if we're never missing a swap, that really hits the NPS, which is a net promoter score. That really hits swapping station distribution. So we know that we've got X number of swaps happening at X number of times. So this ensures that, you know, we're seeing how each swapping station is doing. We're seeing also the frequency of people coming to that swapping station. We're seeing failure rates of that swapping station. So that swap component has a lot of like micro things that we're monitoring that just really give us a bit of a health of the business. Because when you're looking at swaps, that means people are probably going to buy a motorcycle. Why? Because the biggest question for anyone who's buying electric motorcycle, vehicle, whatever, is the infrastructure and range anxiety initially.
Yeah. Right?
Even in Europe, it's the same. Even in the US, it's the same. Range anxiety is one of the biggest things that's holding back electric vehicles. And in Kenya, because motorcycles are bought new, you never really... The price parity between a petrol bike and an electric bike is very close, almost to being the same. And what's driving that is just the size of the batteries. They're much smaller. And so we are angling to also make that bike equivalent or cheaper than a petrol bike. And the total cost of ownership is already cheaper at our price point currently, which is about, you know, $1,600-$1,700 for a motorcycle. So, yeah, it's the swap, that's kind of like our stake in the ground. That's our firm line. Never miss a swap. That's a guarantee we want to make to customers. And that's a way we're going to look at how well the business is performing over time.
What's your take on the whole battery problematic? You know, when people talk about e-mobility, inevitably they'll talk about, okay, not sustainable because of batteries, because of a fight for raw materials and so on. What's your general opinion of that?
That's a great question. I think it's a tough one, because when I think about the value chains, or currently small operator, it's very difficult sometimes to enforce where batteries come from. I was watching a video about Apple and Apple sending engineers into Foxconn and saying, this is who you source from, this is who you won't source from. And actually, they've got a lot of investments, I think nearly $9 billion in machinery in China, specifically to ensure quality standards of how great CEO and iPhones are. But when you think about the raw material sourcing, it's it's inevitable that, yeah, you are going to look at lithium, and mining lithium is pollutive. We're looking now at what's the total cost or what's the total lifespan of the asset that covers up for the emissions. It's quite interesting when you're looking at carbon emissions and trying to calculate the shipping emissions, emissions made from making the frame, and even from mining the raw material. And so a lot of different ways I think about it as well is recycling is getting a lot better for lithium-ion batteries. It's tough to do right now, but it's getting a lot better. We are being responsible. We track every single battery. We know the cycle life. We make sure that once a battery hits its end of life, we amalgamate them and share that with recyclers, or have a second life application in terms of solar systems, etc. But we're really also monitoring and seeing the battery makers, because remember, Mali doesn't make any batteries. And we're hoping that something like a carbon battery would be interesting to come out. So there's a lot of research going into better and better batteries. But when you look at the alternative of saying, what else is there? Petrol bike? Hydrogen is really difficult to implement. It's quite costly. So when kind of one of the mentalities I adopt is net positive as opposed to perfection, and where you can ensure that you can be really ruthless in choosing the best things for the company and for the consumer. Yeah, because at the end of the day, nothing is a perfect solution, but the world is changing. I don't think the world is dying. I think the world's going to be quite all right without humans, probably better. But for us to continue living here as a species, some of these things, I think, this seems to be currently the best solution in the market.
Two things. One, simply a statement of, I very much agree and like that you highlight that the world's going to be very fine without us. Like, yeah. It's not the world that's dying, that's us as a species.
Yeah.
Very important to highlight that, I think. And a question. You mentioned this attitude of looking at things as net positive overall, right? Mm-hmm. I imagine you also had to go through a learning process to arrive at this statement. And so I wonder a bit, like, while building Mali, what was like your last aha moment, like when something like really hit you, okay, this is how we should be doing things, or okay, now I understand how this works?
I spent a lot of time on the shop floor, very workshop driven, and spent a lot of time with the team. And I think we were looking at whether or not we were going to do a specific type of bike or a specific type of battery, and just really testing things out. And we brought out a swapping station, and we built our own wiring harness, and we connected it. And then we went out and tested it with just different connectors and different wiring. And it just was like, oh man, like, this is hitting a 95% success rate. This is getting towards 99%. The quality is getting quite there. Things are moving in the right direction. It kind of just like was a really cool moment when we got all the data collected and we had a finished product, and it was like, this was made by Mazi. You know, because when you think about everybody else, I think people learned, I won't say make, but mostly do assembly, which is quite different from properly manufacturing. And I think it was quite cool to have the station we've been working on for a year just kind of come out, and people just be excited about it, and the team really excited about it, and how it's able to relay information to us on the back end. Or when we're with some investors, I had someone seated a couple of tens of kilometers away, press a button, and the swapping station maintenance was done. So this is, again, it's like really achieving the vision. I think for me, it wasn't really a specific aha moment, but very many like confirmations that this is the right path. This is a product that we can commercialize, scale, that's made on the continent, and that has utility.
What's the problem you're currently trying to solve?
A lot of problems I'm currently trying to solve. I think one thing we're trying to figure out is what's really that way you go from, say, 55 to 1,000. Right, I think 55 to 150 is going to be a big learning. I think 150 to 500 is going to be another big learning. I think 500 to 1,000 will be another, not such a big learning. And I think from there, it begins to become replicable. That in between, that real figuring out that scaling up part is what concerns me, because there's a lot that's going on between figuring out the right SOPs, standard operating procedures, to just thinking about who we need to hire, how does the culture of the team reflect what we're trying to do, and how can we make that culture sticky, and how can we attract the right people? Because at the end of the day, the team is everything, right? You're only as good as your team, and your team is only as good as the culture you build. And so as a CEO, as a founder, that rests squarely on my shoulders to ensure that it's a great culture and people feel motivated to work on hard problems, right? Whether it's figuring out battery size, weight, chemistry, plugs for the motorcycle, or whether it's going to be this or this type of frame or this and this type of motor, you know, that's down to building the battery casing up to the strategy stuff. I think my conundrum now is just making sure that runs really, really well and we can be buttressed for the growth that is knocking on the door, that is on the horizon, and that when it does come, as it is coming, that we're actually in the process of that, we don't get swept up.
Yeah. As you mentioned culture, like previously we talked about how difficult it is to find hardware engineering talent in Kenya, to attract them, to vet them, and to retain them. And you said that culture was essential to doing all these things. So what kind of culture are you trying to build? What values do you try to incorporate, and how do you live them on a daily basis?
You know, one of the things that we have that's kind of stuck is Ubuntu. And Ubuntu is actually African, mostly South African. That's where I had it the first time, which means I am because you are. And Ubuntu is kind of like this functional, I see it as a very functional, but also very human value, because we are parts of a body. That's how I describe it. And whenever, you know, if the eye doesn't function, sure, you can still move, but like your quality of life is impaired. If your heart doesn't function, you're dead. If your brain doesn't function, you're dead. If your liver doesn't function, you're dead. Your kidneys don't function, you're dead. It's quite crazy to imagine as humans, everything just kind of works all the time for most of us who are fortunate. And we don't even think about it. And so when I think about what Mazi should be, it doesn't matter if you're the CEO or if you're, you know, a janitor or something like this, or even a technician. Everybody's just as equally important. And Ubuntu is that value that connects us all to each other and to the company and to our functions and to our roles that we're able to execute as well as we can, because we know that by us doing a good job, you're enabling other people to do an even better job. So it's kind of like 1 + 1 = 3 is how I think about that value. We've got another one that's, I just came to realize, sounds a bit scary. That's called ruthless execution. I didn't think it was scary, but and I think it's not that the culture is we tear people down. You know, we're ruthless in being kind. We're ruthless in being efficient with our time. We're ruthless in ensuring the customer has the most amazing experience they possibly can. I always tell people that my boss is your boss is not me. Your boss is a customer. Your boss is that motorcycle rider who has a hard job, working 12 hours a day, 6 days a week. That's your boss. And so if he comes in and he has a bad time, that's when I come in as one of managers. Say, the boss said you didn't do a good job. And so that's how I think about the company. It's like these people enable us to exist because of how they live and how they work. And that ties in with one that we also have that's called Experience the Customer. So we've got a few interesting, cool rituals at Mazi that we want to just do to inform and keep up. I won't reveal all of them. But one of the cool ones that I'm thinking of is just ensuring that all C-suite or all executive members can fully assemble a motorcycle from scratch. Because if you're a Mazi...
How close are you to that?
I'm getting better. I did a few. I ride a motorcycle every day. I delivered pizzas in Nairobi. I think I was telling you, for 2 weeks on a bike. And so it's one of those things, like really experiencing other customer fields. I wanted it, if you're Mazi executive and you're riding around, you're driving around, you see a Mazi bike on the road, you can stop by and even lend a helping hand if possible, right? Because that's great.
I love that. I don't know if you've heard about it, probably not, but like in Germany, there was this story about a company called Gorillas. Mm-hmm. They were the fastest company to ever reach $1 billion valuation in Germany. Mm-hmm. And people are debating if they are a success or not, but essentially it's just food delivery on bikes. And the founder was making sure to still take rides himself, make deliveries, especially in the early stages all the time, mm-hmm. to like stay close to the riders and so on. Yeah. So I love how you're trying to, how you're basically emulating. You get my point. I love it. Yeah.
I would say, I didn't know that, but that's quite cool. I think it's also just like a really good human way to stay connected. As a CEO, as a founder, sometimes you live on this cloud and you look at strategy, you're looking always, like what Jeff Bezos said, is his job is to live 2 or 3 years in the future. I think you also need to kind of have that, seeing the forest for the trees as it was, but also still being very, very granular, very in the weeds of things as well. Some investors say it's almost like you have a schizophrenic brain where you're like, you know, just like looking all over the place. But I think it's really key. And I think anyone who's going to come into Mazi needs to just understand that's what we are.
Okay. I want to, like, I'm reflecting on our conversation and imagine I was a young hardware founder. I went to start my business in Kenya. You have a napkin to write down your most essential learning so far for the early stages that you have gone through. For me, what do you write down on that napkin?
So you're a young hardware founder.
Yeah. Right? In Kenya.
I would say one, less engineers, more technicians. Because what you realize is that technicians are more handy. Engineers know the theory, but sometimes they can't really do physical stuff, especially in Kenya. Secondly, partnerships. Get a uni that you partner with, get industrial attachment that you partner with, or technical school. We've done that. It's been really, really good. Thirdly is figure out how to bridge international teams with local engineers. So there's a lot of really smart, as much as I said, it's tough to get engineering talent. There's a lot of really smart engineers in Kenya. I think the issue is just that upskilling and understanding how to do things practically. I think that's one of the things why people like Mazi is they get to work on things that engineers do, right? We've got a lot of engineers that study and graduate and never really do any engineering work per se. And so pairing that enthusiasm and willingness to learn with someone who is experienced and skilled and understands the technicality and can review that kind of work really enables you to almost 10x your team's potential because you're able to unlock interesting things and you're able to really build that. So sometimes you might need the senior talent that's not from Kenya or sometimes even not from the region, but then who can understand your team. So your team provides a local context and the senior talent provides the engineering questions and X, Y, and Z. I think that can be a very powerful combination.
To bring things to an end, I would like you to make a few predictions. First one, where is Mazi in 10 years?
You know, it's always tough to to predict 10-year questions.
Ah, come on, you need to be a visionary founder. Paint the picture for me.
It's interesting, I think, when I think about 10 years, sometimes I never even, because again, it's Africa's leading moving people, data, and things. We have a hand in nearly every African country when it comes, we've really canvassed East Africa, done some work in North Africa, so almost in every African region, probably not country, but region. Where we are not only doing motorcycles, you know, we've introduced a new product line. We're running software for some of the best mobility applications in different places. We're releasing data reports on continents. That's open source. That's one of the things I really want us to do, is just, and I struggle with is getting really good data. And I am happy to do a bit of open sourced information out to the world. So even in bike number, you know, million plus motorcycles, maybe. We are handling swaps almost to the billion a year mark, right? Because we know the number of motorcycles is increasing at 15% CAGR year on year. So if that's going to be the trend, then we're going to look at least 30 to 50 million motorcycles in 10 years. So if we're looking at that number, how many swaps are happening on a per day basis? You're doing two. So again,
many swaps.
Millions and billions of swaps a year. It's interesting to think about 10 years from now, because the business is just so rapidly evolving. But if it was my prediction, that would be my best bet.
Yeah. What's your thesis for the African miracle? I've told you about it before. Do you know what I mean? How are entrepreneurs going to sustainably transform the African continent?
I think multiple ways. I think there needs to be a revaluation of how we see government. And there needs to be more collaborative approaches amongst industry players. So government policy is critical. I mean, it's what enables Europe. It's what enables America. Government needs to understand why things need to happen. Because at the end of the day, the government wants to give people better jobs, because that's how they get elected, right? That's the thing. So if you're able to demonstrate value to the government and value of what you've been able to build, that can really have a ripple effect. And that can be done through societies, associations, and committees with different industry players that can show up to government and lobby government. I think the lobbying arm of African entrepreneurs needs to just get better. And how you do that is just by having a few more people in there with you. I think one of the things is being really strategic with your partners and how you raise capital. Because there's a lot of people who want to invest in Africa but don't understand Africa. And I think having that clear way that you're able to express yourself as an entrepreneur, and have partners that can even advocate for you, who understand what those investors want, think, and feel, can be quite useful in drawing in this capital. And then you need to de-risk your business. So if you can get as many grants as possible and non-dilutive funding that can cover the riskier areas of your company and make that more palatable. This is assuming you're raising VC money. Again, as African entrepreneurs, so many different kind of people. If there's a venture-backed type of person, it's a bootstrap type of person, it's a small business type of person. So I'm kind of thinking about it from the VC standpoint. And then I think beyond that is just have a great culture in your company. If more African companies have greater culture, then you can even attract people who live in Europe, or people who live in America, or people who live, whatever the case may be, in Asia, to come and work in Africa, because great culture and working on a hard problem is something that people who are uniquely motivated across the world want, right? And I think one of the many places, or the few places, sorry, that people are solving real tangible human problems happens to be here on the continent. Like, the impact is outside. It's not just another dating app you're building. You're literally changing someone's life by doing X, Y, or Z. And I think that's such a big call to action. That's so inspiring that people who live abroad and can see a sense of, okay, this is a company I'd want to work for, solving this really cool and challenging problem. That's a way to draw them in. The culture just needs to be excellent. Because if you've got a good team, you've got government support, you've got the funding, then it's about really understanding your customer, so that you're not just throwing money at a problem that's not real, or you're not listening to what they're telling you. So I think it's also quite important to listen to what your customers are telling you. And sometimes evaluate, is this, like, why are they saying this? Is this really what they want? Or are they saying this because this is how they're, like, is that the key thing they're trying to bring out? I'll give an example. With e-mobility, sometimes you had customers say, we want a battery that lasts, 250 kilometers. But the last 250 kilometers is so big, so it also brings drag on the bike, but it's also very expensive. And so they wouldn't pay for that, but they want that. So the question is, how do you figure out, how do you give your customer what they want? What are they really telling you? Why do they want the 250 kilometer battery? Because they're scared that they will run out of battery. So if that's the key issue, that's the overarching challenge, that's where the fear is, there are multiple ways to figure that out. And the one that the customer goes to is, I want a bigger battery, because bigger battery needs more range. So I think asking good questions is critical to understanding what your customers want. You know, Steve Jobs was always like, give customers what they want before they know what they want. But I think one of the ways he was able to do that, just from thinking about my experience, is just asking really great questions to consumers and then giving them what they didn't think they wanted, because he asked really good questions. So I think the quality of your questions determines the quality of your business, determines the quality of your of what you're able to do. Yeah.
Let's take your point of questions as the final point to bring this all together. I hope my questions were right for you, but what is something that you would like to tell me that I did not ask you about? And that's the final point of this interview.
So we are going to be planning a trip, cool trip. You didn't ask me about this trip. So Mazi, we are a bit of one of our previous values is adventurous ambition. So we're not scared to go where people are, and we are willing to try new things. So we've devised a very cool strategy. We got invited to COP28, and we are planning a ride from Nairobi to Dubai on an electric motorcycle. It's about 7,500 kilometers plus, and we are planning on leaving on October 1st. So if you're listening to this and you're keen on supporting us on this journey, or can provide any interesting feedback, that could either be we're trying to fund a budget, but beyond that, just know someone in Sudan, Ethiopia, Eritrea, Egypt, Saudi, please reach out. That would be amazing. Or can provide any other kind of support in any ways. If you know something technical, we've done an overland trip before, or you know people who'd be willing to support this financially, that'd be amazing, because we want to showcase that really cool ideas and solutions to climate can come out of the continent, driven by African entrepreneur from an African company. We want to shock the bureaucrats of COP28 when we tell them, hey, they're solution providers, right? And they're coming out of the continent. We're just one among many.
Thank you so much for taking the time. All the best with shocking bureaucrats. I love it. So enjoy the ride and all the best. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Pascal. You're welcome to join us if you like.